Rules of engagement governing ground conflict in urban areas. If possible, the enemy will be warned first, then asked to surrender. Deadly force is the last resort.
Podcast. My name's Mike, and this is episode 8, Rules of Engagement. And joining me for episode 8 is a new guest, and no doubt will be a repeat guest on the podcast going forward, is my lovely wife, Emma.
Hi.
We're here to talk about a document that we released on our website called the Objective Secure Gamers Bill of Rights, which kind of covers a lot of the expectations of the TOs and what the players can expect from the TOs for the events that we host and run. And we've had quite a number of questions via the website and via the Facebook page around some of the points that we raise in this document. And we thought it might be a good idea to obviously have a chat about it and go through some of the pertinent points, particularly the ones that have caused the most questions, and kind of clarify a few things for people listening who can then go away and obviously if they've got further questions, get in touch with us. But before we get into that part of the topic, we're going to have a quick chat to my non-gamer wife and find out a little bit about her gaming experience, which is going to be fairly limited.
I was going to say that should be quite a quick conversation.
So, you're not a gamer.
I'm not a gamer.
You have been involved in this since day one.
So in Objective Secured since day one and in 40K since day one of us starting dating. So that's 18 years of 40K experience from an outsider's point of view. How's that?
You got eased into it in the early days.
Yeah, true. You did try and hide it from me for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably the safest bet. There's
a lot of guys out there listening to this nodding going, yep, yeah. You did that right.
Yeah.
So as you just alluded to, we have been together a long time now, so you have seen my model collection grow over the years and the paints come and go and all sorts. And particularly in the last 2 years, there's been a lot of change in the way the hobby interacts in our world.
Yeah, you can no longer hide things and say, oh, this box, no, I've had this years.
There's a lesson here for you, boys. If she knows what she's looking at or she can identify it by name or understands the terminology, you can't hide it anymore.
No.
You have to start going to more and more exclusive items from Forge World so that she doesn't recognise the terminology.
Yeah, we used to have a deal that if he died first, I had to ask friends how much everything was worth so I didn't sell it for what he told me he paid for it. But now I actually know what it's worth, so...
Sadly.
Yeah.
So your primary... I mean, we've played a little bit over the years. We had one half of Blood Bowl many, many years ago, which you beat me 2-0 in the first half.
And then you cried and you wouldn't play with me again.
It's one of the reasons why I'm not going to teach you 40K in the short term.
Yeah, that's why.
So the difference is, though, that you've had quite a lot of experience helping run events over the last 2 years. I mean, we must have run nearly a dozen events now over the last 18 months or so.
No, that's right. We've started running events together. Was that 2003? We ran that first one out at Outpost.
We've done a couple at one of the local gaming clubs here in Perth, Outpost 6030, which we have mentioned on the podcast before.
Yeah.
And, we did a little one-day skirmish. They used to call them the quarterly events, where they were the little sort of fun throw-together events. And we did... we actually ran Skulls in 2005 after I won it the third year in a row and they told me I couldn't win it the next year. So we did it there, and then I was the president of the club for 2004 and 2005. And then we had our first child and the hobby, at least contact with the clubs, kind of dried up a little bit as... you know, life changed and children and after work commitments and so on.
Yeah.
And then most recently, obviously, the kids are a little bit older now and we decided that we wanted to re-engage that community that we knew was out there but had kind of isolated itself within itself.
Yeah, I guess, and it's probably something that I've talked to a lot of the players at the events. I kept hearing from you and from the other guys who would come around here, oh, 40K in WA is dead. And sort of going, well, no, it's not, because I know it's not dead because you guys are all still playing it. And, you know, if I can name 30 people who are playing it, how many people out there are there that are playing that I don't know about or that you don't know about? And I guess over the last 18 months, now we know a lot more of those people who are playing 40K.
Yeah, look, we've had a huge response over the last 18 months. And I'd like to think part of that's due to our own expectations and the standards that we've tried to set ourselves to up the ante, as it were, and provide as high quality event as we possibly can, and you know, taking feedback on board and trying to look for new and interesting ways of providing events for the community. We don't run the same event twice across the whole year. We offer doubles events, team events, narrative events, the competitive events. We do an intro event at the start of the year for both the major Games Workshop systems. And we're branching out into other game systems as those communities reach out and say, look, you guys are doing this for 40K and you started doing it for Age of Sigmar, can you come and do it for us?
Yeah.
So it's been really inspiring for us, I think I can say for both of us, that these communities have embraced us and come out. And I think the Bill of Rights kind of takes that on board as well, because we talk about what players can expect from the events that they attend as page one. And then we go on to talk about what we as organisers expect from the players in regards to their behaviour and also the forces that they bring to our events, because we do try and maintain such a high standard.
I think it's really important that rights and responsibilities go both ways. So, you know, players have a right to attend a certain level of event, and we have a responsibility to provide that and to make sure that we are, I guess, providing the best possible event to the best possible standard that we can. So it's really important that we do spell out what players can expect from us. But vice versa, if we don't spell out what we expect from, as you say, from players' conduct, or then we can't come back and go, hey, guys, that's not on. So really, I think it's just about transparency and about making sure that everyone knows where we all stand.
Yeah, look, I think the community in WA has fluctuated over the years in regards to a few of these standards, and I think they're all kind of a given for most people who've been to an organised play event before. I think it's important that there is a standard set for new people entering the community, and I think that having it spelled out in a written way, even if it requires clarification in the form of a podcast or someone getting in touch with us, it at least starts the conversation and makes people actually start to think about the events and what it means to them and what they can do to make the event better and what their obligations are and certainly what they can expect from us.
Yeah, so, and I think that's one of the things that we always, you know, we talk about together is the importance of feedback from anything we do, because if somebody's having an issue with something that we're doing either at an event or something that we're publishing, something that we're posting, if you've got a question about it, chances are if you're questioning it, somebody else is. And if nobody lets us know, then we can't address that and we can't let you know why we've made that decision, or we can't clarify it, or we can't go back and reflect on it and possibly change that decision. So getting the feedback on the Bill of Rights around the the questions that we have been receiving gives us a chance to go, hey, actually, yeah, we know what this means, but obviously we just need to clarify this a little bit so other people know what we mean as well.
There's a couple of parts of the document that have... I had a fairly lengthy conversation with one of our attendees / listeners / readers yesterday or the day before, I forget which, and he highlighted inadvertently... Now, he didn't ask me to change anything in the document. He didn't do anything like that. But on reflection, there are a couple of points that he raised that need to have some further clarification added to the document to make sure that it's as understandable for the average player as possible. Not to take anything away from him that he doesn't understand things, but like you've just hinted at then, what we take for granted because it's in our heads and it makes sense to us doesn't necessarily mean that someone external to what our conversations and thought processes are will.
And that's it exactly. Like, this wasn't something that you just sat down and wrote in 10 minutes. We talked about it and we'd had at-length discussions. So, of course, we know what these points mean because we've been talking about it for 10 days.
It's even more than that. I think this, and I hinted at the blog post when we posted this, was that this is a document that's been brewing now for what is essentially 18 months of feedback and development from the players.
Yeah.
There's always been some vagaries of it in the players' packs, and I think this just gives us an opportunity to remove some of that clutter from a player's pack and to set a standard expectation for every event.
Mm.
And it's one that I think most of the clubs in Perth have some version of it.
Yeah.
I know Outpost still use one of the original versions of it that was written back in the early 2000s as part of their standard players' packs, and that was certainly part of the inspiration for us looking to develop this. So I don't know. I think the document doesn't need to be scary. We just, I suppose, we want to talk about one part specifically on this recording, and we'll touch on the other pages as well. But the one that we've had a lot of feedback from is around painting, what you see is what you get, modelling, basing, and the nitty-gritty of getting an army ready for an OBSEC event. Now, that's not to take anything away from the other pages, but that's the one that we've had a lot of queries about.
Mm.
And we'll kind of get stuck into that in a second and kind of explain the evolution of that particular page in just a moment. But we'll take a quick break now and we'll be back to talk about the main topic in just a second. So we're going to go through the Bill of Rights now. We're going to touch on the first two pages and then sort of delve into the third page, which is where most of the questions have come from. So loosely, the document is formatted into a format that covers what you can expect and what we expect from you on the first page in terms of conduct and venue and all the rest of it. We're going to go through those in just a second. Then page two is all about sportsmanship and conceding games and some nitty-gritty there. And again, there's some reasoning for the integration of that stuff into this document. And then the big one, which is the assembly, painting and basing section on page three, which is where most of the questions have come from. So why don't we start with page one? And there's 7 points here, and they're all pretty self-explanatory, but I feel like it's worth having them broadcast and obviously having a quick chat if there's any there that we feel there's a need to.
Yep. First point, obviously, have fun and meet new people, which really is self-explanatory, and it's what we've been talking about for the last 18 months, is that our events really are around trying to, I guess, get people together, create a community, and it really does boil down to it's supposed to be fun.
Yeah. And if you're ever going to an event that's not fun, then there's obviously something there that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. And if you come to one of our events and it's not fun, tell us.
Yeah. And we've taken a lot of feedback on board, not necessarily because it's not been fun, but
yeah. We've
made changes to every event, and WATC that we've just completed was off the back of a bunch of feedback we had from last year's event.
Mm.
So, have fun. It's a game, people. You've got to remember that. It's meant to be fun. If you're not having fun, whether it's at a tournament or playing with your mates, take a break.
Yeah.
So, point two?
Point two, play as many games as we can fit into a day, which I actually think is a really interesting point because some events we have had 4 games in a day, and by the probably midway through the third game, most of the players are looking pretty darn wrecked.
Look, I'd forgotten how old I was when I played WATC. We did 4 games in one day, and talking to a friend of mine, Brett, in Queensland, that's the norm. They try and do 4 games in a day.
Yeah.
I was wrecked.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd gone up early that day and packed the trailer and all the rest of it. And by the time we finished, it was late. But even just the games, that was tiring stuff. But I suppose that comes down to a value association.
You don't want to
pay money and then go and play 2 games over an 8 to 10 hour period. I'd struggle with that as a player when I want to go along and play as much as I feasibly can on the day. Now, I've recognised, and certainly the feedback we have from WATC was that 4 games in one day was a big ask.
Yeah.
And we 100% agree.
Yeah, it really was a big ask.
So we're going to take that on board and we'll cut it back to 3 games a day. And obviously with the new version of 40K that's around the corner, we might see it go back to 4 games, depending on how long those games go for.
And I think that's another thing as well, that it depends on how long those games go for. So those games, I know it was only 10 days ago, I'm stretching my mind. Was it 2 hours and 15 minutes?
It was 2 hours and then the 15 minutes was the match-up process.
Okay.
You essentially had what was 9 hours worth of concentration interspersed with 10-15 minute breaks to sort of move models between rooms, between tables. And get yourself set up. And even the lunch break was only 45 minutes, I think it was. So it was a very long day with very little breaks. And I think everyone would have appreciated extending those breaks and dropping a game. But we also wanted to have an overall winner. So it was important that, particularly for a competitive event, I feel like it's important to try and get those overall winners out, depending on the way the scoring structure is set up. So I think for casual events, 3 games is plenty.
Yeah.
But if you feel like you want to do a marathon session and we can get enough players on board, yeah, we can do a much longer day and do more games.
Oh, I'm really not sure we can. We might need a different TO if we're going to be doing that.
Well, we can just bring out like a blow-up mattress and have a sleep in between rounds. It'd be fine.
I have been known to disappear into the green room and have a little nap on the couch.
That's why I can't find you. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll go on to point three.
Okay. So point three is have tournament disputes, rules queries and questions settled by polite and impartial judges.
I think that's a fairly important one. You want to make sure that big events, obviously it almost becomes unavoidable for TOs not knowing players. Like, I think I could safely say that in some way, shape or form, I know 80 to 90% of the players that attend our events without any, you know, just through having them at the events, you're chatting to them and you meet them. There are some people who come to our events that are far closer friends than others who attend events. But I'd also like to
That's also changing as we, you know, the more events we do, they're becoming closer friends, aren't they?
That is true. I mean, the Argonaut Boys on the last episode are a good example of that.
Yeah.
I feel like, though, part of that's also got to do with our integrity and players trusting their TOs to be impartial, despite the fact that there might be someone who is closer to us in the argument. And I've ruled against plenty of my friends, actually, over the last 18 months, whether they've liked it or not. And thankfully, they're adults and grown up enough to accept my decisions, whether I'm right or wrong in the long term, or, you know, they get vilified by the FAQs that Games Workshop produced post that event. Everyone's been grown up enough to accept that. And I think it's important that there is no favouritism shown. And
I think it's important that there's no favouritism shown, but I also think that it's really important that, you know, around that politeness as well, that people will make mistakes when they're, you know, they might have read a rule one way, somebody else reads a rule another, and so a TO is called in to have to make a decision. But that's done in a respectful and and polite manner. I can't think of a better word than polite at the moment. I'm sure there is one, but it's late. So I think, we do make sure that there's no like, how do you not know that? You know,
unless it's Mitch.
but that he deserves that. So
So let's move on to point four.
Okay, so have the event organized and run in a timely manner.
I think we kind of deal with this one pretty well. All of our events start on time, all of them end on time.
Yeah.
And we are fairly strict with the timekeeping. But it is an important one to mention from a timekeeping point of view for players.
Yeah.
A lot of players, and we've enforced it very strictly at WATC, which surprised a few people. We've been known to let players trip over 5 minutes here and there to try and resolve a particularly important game. We made sure at the start of the day we were very clear that that was that. When the time was called, it was dice down and thanks, you know, please stop. And there were a couple of times there where games had to be stopped because the players basically chose to keep playing.
Yeah.
And it's important that every player recognises that it's a responsibility not just of the TOs but of themselves, because we all have places to go, we all have families and stuff to do around the event, and we want to finish on time and we want to make sure that everyone gets home safe, and we want to make sure that there's a level of respect and equality shown across the players so that no one feels like they missed out because they stopped and they're you know, someone else on another table didn't.
Yeah, and I think, so I will come back to our responsibility for this, for starting games on time as well, but we also have a responsibility to make sure that people know that the games are finishing. So throughout the entire rounds, I'm always on the PA going, you know, players, just letting you know you've got 45 minutes of this round left. You've got half an hour of this round left.
You've
got
runners around tables as well.
Oh, yeah, I go around to every table because it doesn't matter how many times I put it over the PA. Nobody hears me.
No, but when you're concentrating on the table and there's white noise in the background from all the other people in the room, it's easy to miss.
Yeah, so, you know, at WATC, I was going around, every single player. I'd start off at one, say, okay, we've got 15 minutes left. By the time I got to the end of the table, I'm saying we've got 5 minutes left. But still making sure throughout it everyone knows how long they have, which gives them the opportunity that they can go, hey, we've got 30 minutes left. Can we actually get another turn in each, or do we need to do something to resolve this now and talking it through? You know, so they have that choice rather than going, oh, well, I didn't know it was ending. So he's had four turns. I've only had three turns. That's not fair.
Yeah. We did have a couple of scenarios where players were trying to avoid stopping halfway through a turn, and I completely understand that as well. There's nothing worse than not completing a turn knowing that it would change the outcome. That said, when you do know how much time you've got, any player who comes to an organised, particularly a competitive event where you are playing to a very strict time clock like you were told at the start of the day, should be going, okay, we've got half an hour to go, we're on turn three, and talking to the opponent and going, hey, look, are we going to end turn four? We've only got half an hour, or can we push for turn five? And then the decisions that you make on the fly then need to be fast and decisive rather than standing there umming and ahhing for 5 minutes because it's your turn, because then that looks like you're time wasting.
Yeah.
And your opponent then starts getting a bit antsy because you're essentially wasting time. And it's almost certainly not intentional, but it can be perceived that it is.
Yeah.
And it's important that no one feels like they're missing out.
Because, they're being cheated because you've wasted valuable time.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I had two games where we pushed and you make snap decisions and they might be good or they might be bad. Mm. And we actually had a game stop halfway through a turn and the player in question was not upset, but he was a bit frustrated by the fact that he didn't get to finish because he felt it would have changed the outcome.
Yeah.
So we scored the game as the table ended, and then we played out the next 5 minutes, just resolved those key things that he felt might have changed it. And ironically, it didn't change a thing.
Mm.
And he walked away from the table much happier. Now, that's always an option because you've got a 15-minute break. As long as your results are in,
yeah,
you want to spend those 15 minutes resolving those last little things to give yourself some closure. There's nothing wrong with that, but obviously those results can't count.
No, and yeah, so when it comes down to the responsibilities, we have a responsibility to make sure that the day starts on time, and we have a responsibility to make sure that the players know how long they've got left. But the players have a responsibility to make sure that they're getting those scorecards in and up to the TO's desk as quickly as possible, because otherwise that actually impacts on every other player that's in the room. And so, yeah, at WATC, where we did have to go over and say, seriously, guys, dice down, it is done, because otherwise we would have had 70 other players in the room waiting because they were still trying to finish a turn. And so I think it's knowing that your actions impact a lot more than just yourself and your opponent.
Yeah. Not to mention the pack-up time at the end, and, you know, it does snowball, and 5 minutes here and there across two or three rounds, all of a sudden you're half an hour late.
Yeah.
We'll move on, though. Next point.
Next point is play in a reasonably comfortable environment.
We won't talk too much about this, but
yeah.
We always try and make sure we have air-conditioned venues wherever we possibly can, even if that air-conditioning is, well, not keeping up with the body heat and the heat of the day. We do our best to make sure the venues are air-conditioned. We make sure that there's plenty of room around the tables wherever we possibly can.
We always make sure we have deodorant at the front of the TO desk so as to, you know, make things just that little bit more comfortable for everyone.
Yeah. On the topic of the tables, very quickly, we have been toying with the idea of butting tables up to try and make more space, and I think that still meets the criteria of this point. I think the key part is that you don't want to be in a situation where you're sharing your space with someone behind you playing on another table and you're having to kind of jockey for position around the left-hand or right-hand side of the table, depending on whose bum needs to be in that space at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that also if we are looking at doing this, and if we put two tables or even three tables running in a row together, it's still manageable that you can walk around the table relatively easily. Whereas if we get to a point where we're putting 10 tables in a row,
it's not viable.
I don't think that that's viable, because by the time it takes you to walk the whole, you know, if you're on table five and you got to walk the whole way around to get to the other side of the table, that gets a little bit ridiculous. And like you said, you know, as lovely as the guys are that are in the room and as close as some of those friends have become, you probably don't want to be rubbing bums.
Well, most of them don't. Moving on.
Okay, so have every other player held to the same standard?
Again, this is, we've kind of hinted on this already, it's about mutual respect.
Mm.
So we can't have double standards regardless of any pre-existing relationships. We can't be seen to be favouring one person over another for any particular reason. And if we expect dice down from one player, we can't then be leaning with someone else.
Yeah.
I don't really have anything else to cover with that one, so we'll just move straight on to the last point, point seven.
Play games in a safe and relaxed atmosphere.
We won't talk too much about this, but this basically goes into that whole aggressive, like really bullying kind of mannerisms that some people can pick up when things get heated. And I'm not saying that they're necessarily doing it on purpose, but
I don't think I've ever seen that or experienced it at the events.
Not our events. I've seen it get quite heated internationally, and I know there was almost a punch-up on one of the ETCs a couple of years ago. And sadly, alcohol can play a factor in that as well.
But
I think the key part is if you're ever feeling unsafe or someone's using any sort of discriminatory language, racial slurs or anything like that, that's not okay. And it's our job to tell them that's not okay and then take the appropriate action up to and including removing them from the event.
And it's an interesting point. And so under here it does say around, you know, it does talk about language and aggressive behaviour. And I guess what's the interesting thing with that is the language that's deemed appropriate differs around Australia. But I think that swearing is not, you know, it happens, and we're not saying that people can't swear at events, because otherwise
tone plays a part.
That's exactly it. And so we have some players who
are sailors.
We do, which is completely fine. You know, they're just words. It is the tone, and it's the I guess what you're meaning with that word. You know, if you're meaning your language to be aggressive, then it's not okay. But if you're, you know, if that's just the language you use and it comes with a positive intent, then that's okay as well.
I think it also comes down to how well you know the person you're playing, because being on your best behaviour with someone you've never met before should be a given, whereas if it's someone that you play every other day and you guys have that sort of banter, that's completely fine. But you still have to be aware of the people around you who might, you know, starting to use specific slurs that are deemed inappropriate in today's society. You still can't use that in a public place because there might be people around you. So we'd like to think, though, that the majority of players, if they feel uncomfortable with that sort of language, will come and speak to us. We'll be able to go and talk to that player, and that player will generally, or should certainly, be contrite and respectful and be more aware of it for future.
Yeah.
I don't ever envisage us having to eject someone for this clause.
No, and I was just going to add to that that we do also have players who, they're so into the game that the noises that they make are just, they're just...
I want Russell on here to wah. I think that'd be amazing, a recording. I don't know whether the speakers will hold up.
I really don't think they will, and you'd certainly have to turn the volume down when you're listening to it. But it really does make a difference to the atmosphere of the event, like having the players who are just so completely involved in it, and that they're just guttural kind of primal instinct.
You didn't see me play game one at WHSC, did you? Because I was making pew pew laser noises.
Oh, I'm really upset I missed that.
So I completely get that.
Yeah.
So that's page one. Go and have a read of it. It's on our website. It's in the useful links tab. We're going to move on to part two now, and we're not going to talk too much about this one. This particular section covers sportsmanship and conduct. Now, I suppose the most important part of this to take away is this is the ITC tournament standard. So we've chosen to adopt this format because we're obviously moving to an ITC format. Now, what that means for 8th edition, who knows? However, I feel like a lot of it really articulates the expectations to the player quite clearly. It also means that we can obviously overwrite it, where it talks about thumbs up and thumbs down for sportsmanship scoring. We can obviously put it in the player's pack and adjust that. But what it does give us is the ability to police people's conduct at tournaments where we don't necessarily score sportsmanship. It gives us a fallback that if someone is behaving inappropriately, we have a standard in place that people should adhere to and follow. The key difference, I suppose, from previous events, though, is the final section around conceding games and withdrawing from the tournament and how those games are scored. So they are the standards that's used for the ITC events over in America and on the East Coast. We're just basically picking them up and making them the default response unless there's something else in the player's pack. And to be fair, no one's said two words about this page. So no. Hopefully it's because it is very clear and concise. If you do have any feedback on that page, by all means, get in touch and let us know.
I think most of the stuff around the conduct and sportsmanship is really summed up in the first line where it says players are expected to conduct themselves in a positive and civil fashion. Like, that's what we expect of people.
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing we normally add is you're expected to speak English and use appropriate language.
You're expected to speak English if you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I mean by that is if your opponent only speaks English, don't stand there and speak to them in Portuguese.
Yeah.
And that mainly applies to the international events that I've attended more than anything else, where you do have, you know, bilingual or multilingual people who native language is in English. But I include it in there because people come from all walks of life and they might be used to speaking a certain language at home and English might not be their first language.
No.
Anyway, so we're going to move on to page three, which is, I suppose, the one that we've had most of the questions about. And we're now going to talk primarily about the hobby side of our events, what needs the players have for their hobby in terms of assembly, what you see is what you get, or WYSIWYG as it's known, painting, basing, and then obviously talk a little bit about what happens with commission armies and how we score those at tournaments as well. So before we get into that, though, I want to make it very clear that this is not a reason for us to penalize people. It's not a document that's designed to be excluding people. It's about trying to create some standards for the community to really lift the feel of an event to make it a really positive experience for everyone. Yep. It's not us trying to be dictators and be horrible and ruin your fun, but we are trying to create an environment where everything looks fantastic and that is part of the experience. So I'll let Emma sort of kick off and we'll kind of see where this goes.
So obviously one of the first points that we've got is around just, I guess, covering that we are aware that every single player that comes into one of our events has a different level of skill. So I guess I just want to make sure that people know that this particular page doesn't mean that you have to put an army on the table that is Golden Demon standard.
Yeah.
And that's what you were talking about before. You know, we're not hoping to exclude people
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, one of the gentlemen who kicked off our upset painting challenge, Steve.
Yeah.
Steve readily acknowledges the fact it takes him an eternity to paint single miniatures, let alone get them close to finished.
Yeah.
He acknowledges that, and I hope he doesn't mind me sharing that online.
Probably should have checked that before he started
He says it publicly at the club, so I'm going with it. And he was concerned that he would be excluded.
Yeah.
Now, the goal isn't to exclude anyone. The goal is simply to make sure that everyone understands that our goal is to provide a visually interesting and diverse and really sort of involve everyone in the broader experience that is whatever game you're playing.
And the reason that we made that decision is from the feedback that we had from players and from the community, that people want to play with armies that are fully painted against armies that are fully painted.
Yeah. The definition of fully painted, I suppose, is the key part of that.
And that's one of the things that we're going to talk about, yeah. So,
but let's start with the first
fully
one.
Fully assembled is obviously the first part that we want to discuss.
This is, I suppose, an important one, and there are a couple of guidelines in this as well. In most game systems, a model's silhouette is very important.
Mm-hmm.
A model's size and shape tends to be fairly important. And for some games where you do have the opportunity to change equipment or weapons or the way a model behaves on the table through different upgrades, it is important that the model reflects that. And this clause is there to make sure that players understand that those things are important. So obviously the fully assembled side of it means that a model should be identifiable as what it is. It should be the right size and shape for any line of sight issues that a game might require you to have. If you're using a proxy army, come and show us. We've had plenty of cool armies been shown to us. Hey, I'm using these dinosaur riding space marines as thunder cavalry. And the guy's shown me photos and I've gone, they're the right size, they're on the right base. They've got a similar silhouette in that they are a big cavalry riding monster thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're awesome. We're not going to exclude your conversions because it's not the official model. But what we're trying to achieve is a situation where your conversions are reflective of what an opponent can reasonably expect to see.
Yeah.
We had a giant dinosaur at WATC being used as an orc stomper.
Yeah.
Now that player did the right thing. He came to me 2 weeks ahead of when the lists were due, said, this is what I'm doing, showed me pictures, gave us ruler measurements on how tall it was, how wide it was, and worked with us to make sure that it got as close as possible within his aesthetic designs to the right size and shape.
Yeah.
Was it perfect? No. But he did everything we asked, and he made the effort to not only go to all the effort of converting it and making it look cool, but he worked with us to make sure it was appropriate for the event.
Yeah, and that comes down to, I think, we need to make sure that the players are playing with armies that they want to be playing with.
Yeah.
So if you want to be playing with an army that's, you know, whatever, riding dinosaurs, and then we don't want to say, oh, well, tough luck because there's no dinosaurs in this particular.
Yeah.
You know, so you can't do that. Like, it's your army. They're your models. We just need to make sure that they do fit the standards. And
yeah. And look, part of that is encompassed in WYSIWYG. And this actually comes back to our giant dinosaur stomper friend. The important part about what you see is what you get is that an opponent should be able to easily identify anything that's required to be identified. I know that sounds like a really silly sentence, but let's use Warhammer 40,000 as the example because it's the game I know the best. It's very easy to have a Space Marine carry a dozen different guns. And if your opponent comes to the table and you say, oh, this dude's flamer is actually a melter gun, then I think that, okay, cool, that's a melter gun. What about that flamer? Is that a flamer or a melter gun? Oh, no, that one's a flamer.
Yeah.
And that instantly creates issues because you're then second-guessing it all the way through the game. It slows the game down.
Particularly if you've got 12 of them and they've each got a different weapon.
Yeah. So WYSIWYG, it's very hard to police because bit sites are expensive. A lot of the time the kits don't give you as all the options that you can take. The key is to be consistent and to be clear.
Yeah.
So one of the questions we had was a gentleman with his Genestealer cult where he wanted hand flamers on models. He's made them distinctive and they all match. They're not the official hand flamer models, but he's made an effort to make sure the opponents know what they are. He identifies them at the start of the game. I've suggested he put a different colour or a tattoo or something on them to make them very easy to spot. Mm-hmm. That's up to him. It's an aesthetic choice because he's already made the effort.
Mm-hmm.
But that way his opponents don't feel like they're being ripped off because he's left the flamer models till last to die, when in actual fact they didn't have those weapons.
Yeah.
By making them identifiable, the opponent has a clear
point of reference. Yeah.
So that's actually really important.
And I think that goes down to the overall feeling of the game as well. You don't want to feel ripped off because he didn't tell me that and I feel like actually he was kind of, taking a few liberties there.
If in doubt, ask us. But as a general rule, as long as you are clear and consistent using a proxy or a stand-in or your own conversion for a particular weapon loadout or whatever it happens to be, is fine. The trick is that if one flamer is a melter gun, then all flamers should be melter guns.
Yeah.
They can't be a mix and match there. They need to be identifiable.
Or unless they're painted a different colour or something that makes them easily identifiable.
I mean, ideally, you just cut the barrel off the flamer or change it up so that it is distinctly not a flamer.
Yeah.
But the important part there is your opponent should be able to clearly and easily identify it.
Yeah.
So we'll move on to the second part, which is the painting. Now, this is probably the most contentious one.
I'm not sure contentious is the right word. I just think the one that's
requires
the most clarification. That's right. So, yeah, and we've written in, well, Michael's written in the Bill of Rights that the models must be fully painted. And that goes back to that whole Golden Demon painting standard idea. We're not saying that every model that anybody brings to an event needs to be painted to a Golden Demon standard.
Or even to a what you would consider a finished standard. Now, that sounds a bit strange. Let me kind of elaborate. Again, we had a player who didn't feel like... he got 90% of his army finished to what he considers finished. So all the details are done, all the, you know, our weapons are detailed, the eyes are dotted in, and then one unit wasn't. And I said to him...
So one unit was still bare plastic.
Yeah. And I said to him, well, instead of finishing one of those other units that you were finishing in the lead-up to the event, would you have been able to block in the uniform, the skin colour, the basic weapon colour, and maybe the boots? And that would have easily met the requirement, because to the casual observer walking past the table, every model's painted. And that's the key, is that we felt the three-colour minimum didn't necessarily reflect well, because...
I think the three-colour minimum was too open to loopholes.
Yes. Look, in years gone by, I saw this, not as a TO, but as a player. There was a gentleman who took the three-colour minimum requirement, got a toothbrush.
Yeah.
Put three colours on the tip of the toothbrush in equal measures, and then just ran it down the front of his miniatures and got to the tournament and said they're three-colour minimum because there's three colours on them.
Yeah.
And sadly, I don't think that's a common thing, but I do...
No, but I have actually seen, models where somebody's got a dot of this colour paint and a dot of this colour paint and a dot of this colour paint and gone, there's three colours on it.
Yeah, and look, we don't want to police people's hobbies, but that's clearly not...
It's not in the intent. It's in the spirit of it. That's right.
So, you know, I would go so far as to say that if you've planned your army out and you've submitted your list a couple of weeks out, you should have a very clear understanding and idea of how to get those basic colours down. And let's face it, most of these armies, you talk about the Space Marines for Warhammer, for 40K, and you paint their armour a colour, you paint the bolters or their weapons in black, and you paint the shoulder pad trim, and you're done. You don't have to go back and repanel all the armor plates, and you don't have to go back and shade and highlight and do eye lenses and all that sort of stuff. But if someone walks past the table, they should be able to say, oh, wow, it's a Space Marine army, and they all look similar.
Yeah, and I guess in an ideal world, you'd have your whole army in front of you, and, you know, and you'd go, okay, well, they're all getting undercoated. They're all getting, you know, their...
People
armor
look
done
differently, though.
They do, that's right. And it's not an ideal world either, because you might have got an army that you've used for this particular event and then gone, okay, well, I want to change a little bit, or the points value is different, so you have to add a unit or change a unit, which means you've got to start all over again. So, you know, in an ideal world, every model that gets put on the table would be finished to the same standard.
Yeah.
But we know that that's not necessarily going to happen. But yeah, like you said before, what we would like to see is that every model looks as though it's painted. So they've all got their base colours there, and they've got their bases painted as well.
Look, and it also then allows us to look at the army in context. So let's use Necrons for Warhammer 40K as the example. They're traditionally painted silver, and they have green eyes, and they get those stupid glowing green rod acrylic pieces of junk that they put in the kit. I can say that. The kit's very old and I hated building mine. But it's very easy to spray them silver, put the green rods in, paint the chest piece. It's a little sort of Egyptian-themed piece in the centre of their chest. You could paint it gold. And technically it's not three colours. But
what about the green eyes?
Well, you could do the green eyes, but...
That's three colours.
Well, but we don't specify the colours.
Yeah, this
and
is true.
And to the casual observer walking past that Necron table, it's a wall of steel robots. They've all got their green rods on them.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they look like they're patients.
They look done. That's it.
So this actually allows us to be a bit more liberal with how we determine that three colours. So going back to the Space Marine example, you might just say for an Imperial Fist army, which are bright yellow, and yellow is a horrible colour to get right.
That's awful.
You can spray them yellow, spray the weapons separate in black, glue the weapons on, and you'd probably get away with that because you've kind of got a situation where you can go back and update those models and work on them as the events go by. But yeah. As someone walking past, if you're playing an Imperial Fist army, it looks like an Imperial Fist army.
Yeah. So it's trying to, I guess, describe the difference between having an army that looks done, but it doesn't necessarily need to be finished.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how to articulate that well.
Steve's Black Templars are a great example. His concern was, oh my God, you know, they're three colour minimum. I said to Steve, they're Black Templars, mate.
Yeah.
They're black. You've done the white shoulder pads. You've done the metal on the weapons.
Mm.
Have you finished them where you've done all the little purity seals and everything on them? No. Your intent is to, but
yeah.
You recognise the fact that you're a fairly slow painter and that you want to do it right and you don't want to waste your time or your money, and that's completely fine. I completely understand that. I've ruined models over the years and had to throw them in paint stripper because I've rushed.
Yeah.
So, but to the, you know, to your opponents, you're making an effort, and when someone walks past the table, they look like Black Templars.
Mm.
Is the black blended through five shades of blue and two shades of grey to get these edge highlights? No. But they look like they're Black Templars.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's kind of the best way to view it. If the model has paint on it in an appropriate way, rather than using a toothbrush or some similar technique,
yeah.
And you've shown that you've made an effort, that's all we ask. And if you turn up and we go, mate, that's... You know, we can see you've made an effort on 99% of it. You'll probably get a verbal warning from us the first time it happens of, please don't do that again. Mm. And then going forward, we'll probably have to look at asking you to remove units from the board from future events if you can't do them. I think it's about knowing your own abilities and your own limits and how fast you get things done and planning for that.
Mm.
And we don't want to be the ones to go out and say, please take these models off the table. We
really don't.
Like, I don't want to be the hobby police. I don't want to be out there ruining someone's weekend because that happened. I'd rather you get in touch with me a week out and say my airbrush... We had it happen at an event.
Yeah.
We had someone's airbrush die 3 days or something before the event.
Yeah.
And we worked with him. Was the army finished? Absolutely not. But he'd made an effort and we'd found a workaround and he'd done his best and...
But that was around, like, he wasn't putting models on the table that were undercoated. That was around finding ways, how can we make it look as though it was finished?
Yeah.
And that was going, okay, so the tracks on your tanks, get them painted. Weapons, make, you know, paint those in. You know, touch up the bases so that it doesn't look as though you've still got your brush marks from the boots on the bases.
Well,
so it's going through, it is going into the next point, I know. But it's going through and going, what can I do that takes this model from looking as though I've sprayed it with one colour to looking as though I've painted my model?
Yeah. So hopefully that means that players have a bit more understanding around that particular point, and that seems to be the one that most people have kind of had the most questions around.
And when I think about it, that's the point that I know you struggled with as well when you were getting ready to go over to LVO. You got yourself in a bit of a state because it said that your army had to be finished. So you needed to make sure that your army was completely finished to a standard that you were happy with across all of it. And then you got there and saw that some people had less than finished armies.
Mm.
So I guess that's one of the other reasons that we wanted to go through and just clarify that a little bit as well.
Yeah, well, I'd like to think that we're not going to be that strict. We're just looking for a show.
No, and that's what I'm saying. We're not saying that you have to get it to the point that it's completely done. That's why we're clarifying it. We're saying it has to be done to a point that it looks as though it's been painted.
Yeah. So you spoke about it very briefly a second ago, but with bases is the third part of this equation.
Yeah.
Now, basing is a very personal thing. I've had several people run armies on acrylic clear bases, and that's
my favourite bases.
Now, I can see an argument there for scoring them differently, but in terms of the event itself, I think they're completely fine. I think that way it actually potentially, or at least in the person's eyes who's done it, will increase their immersion in
that's the what game. I think as well. Yeah, I think it doesn't matter which table they're playing on.
They fit.
Whereas if you're playing on a desert board and you've got snow on your bases, you're like, oh, well.
I suppose that comes down to your own aesthetic choices. And,
of course
and
it does.
Maybe your table at home.
Yeah. I get that. I'm just saying I prefer acrylic.
Look, you heard it here, people. She's let me go and buy clear acrylic bases
for
every model.
No, didn't say that. I tell you what, I prefer acrylic for all of my models. How's that?
I'll start buying them in your name. Moving on.
Yeah, moving on.
But look, with bases, I've had people who don't like texturing bases.
Yeah,
They prefer them either flat black to provide a frame for the work that they've done on the model itself, which I can respect. I've had people who go to town with giant elaborate bases of cork and tile and all sorts. All of those are completely
everything
fine.
In between.
All I would ask, if you're going to use the standard bases that the model is supplied with, that they are tidied up around the model's feet or whatever touches the base, whether it's tails, ankles, feet.
Yeah.
So it looks neat and finished.
Yeah. If you've got a black base, you don't want splashes of purple that you've used on...
on the boots, whatever it is. If you want to apply texture, awesome. A lot of those things will come into the painting scoring.
Yeah.
But as a standard... the goal is to make it neat and tidy and appear finished, whether it's flat black or whether it's something else.
I think painting around the edge of the base as well.
Just tidying it up. Yeah. If you, like me, a lot of my Eldar jet bikes are on the clear flying stems and clear flying bases. Now, I have that particular army, this is the army I took to LVO, has an infantry unit and has a couple of flyers that use a fully textured snow base. And yet the rest of the army is on clear bases.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a few people say to me, oh, well, shouldn't they be on snow bases? And while I can appreciate that as a statement, the only reason that the infantry and the flyers have texture on their bases is because the bases they came supplied with weren't clear.
Mm.
If they were clear, then I would have left the entire army clear.
Yeah.
As it stood, this was my compromise for those bases that I had to texture and couldn't leave for the standards that LVO had implied. It meant that I tied them into my other existing Eldar armies by matching the bases off and left the clear ones clear because that's actually what I would have preferred for the entire army.
Mm-hmm.
But my OCD wouldn't have let me use the clear acrylic because it would have had to have beveled the same way as the bases that they came with.
Oh, good Lord.
Yep, I know. I recognise my failing and I will be sure to correct it. A little one for my Space War fans out there, you'll know what I'm saying there. But that was my compromise, and no one had a problem with that at any of the events I've taken that army to. So just a little bit of effort to tidy up the bases. You can do, if you do like me, I'll build and paint all my bases before I put the models on them. And that's a 2 or 3 hour process, and I'll do 50 bases in one big pass. And then I'll tack glue or use blue tack or some other temporary adhesive, put the model on a spare base, which is what I've got here beside me.
Yeah,
and then paint the model, take it off the temporary base, and then either pin it or however I want to attach it to the permanent base, so there is no over spray or any issues.
Yeah,
however you want to do it's fine, as long as it looks neat and tidy.
And just very, very quickly, because you mentioned blue tack, when people are bringing their models along to events, using blue tack to hold the models together is still completely fine.
Yeah, and that comes back to the original assembly point. We've got a very good friend in Queensland, hi Brett, who is a religious user of blue tack, particularly while he's building and painting armies, and certain large models as well. He's not into magnets. If the model's got gigantic wings and it's hard to transport, you can bet there's a lump of blue tack hidden away in the join that you'll never see, but the wings will come off.
Yeah.
And if you're halfway through building a very complex model like I am right now, I'm painting Magnus the Red and he's in many, many pieces, if I were going to try and put him on the table, you can be damn sure I would be blue tacking the wings in and blue tacking him to the base so that he was the right size and shape for the game. And
because at the moment, he's at a point where, well, actually, I'm not 100% sure. I haven't seen him recently. But I think he's at a point, no, he's not, where he would be okay to go on a table.
No, he's not.
But if he were at a point where he would be okay to go on a table, you don't want to have to glue him together and then go, oh, well, that's awesome. Now I've got to try and snap that super glue so that I can get these details on to actually finish the model.
Yeah. So any of those temporary adhesives, whatever you call it, wherever you are, we know it as blue tack. It's those sort of the sticky putty stuff.
I don't know what else it would be called anywhere else.
I don't know either, but I'm assuming that blue tack is a brand rather than a product.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah.
So the last point on the painting page talks about commission painted armies.
And using borrowed armies as well.
Now, I'm sure at some point in time or another, the majority of us have borrowed a mate's unit to fill in this or that. And whether you rent to a tournament or not, I'm sure you've done it at home. Borrowed and commission painted armies are completely fine. You can bring them along to an event, not a problem. As long as they meet the standards that we've already talked about, completely fine. The trick with them actually comes into the way the events are scored, in that you would be ineligible for any of the painting awards. You'd still get a painting score.
And that painting score would go towards your overall score.
Yeah, if it was included.
If there's
But you wouldn't get the opportunity to win those awards per se.
Yeah.
You'd get recognition.
So you wouldn't get the opportunity to win the painting award, but you would still get the opportunity to win
the overall award
using a painting score.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we had a situation where one of our locals came to us and said, look, I didn't paint my army.
Yep.
He painted part of it from memory, but not all.
Yeah, that's right.
And he was up front and told us, and we went, look, really appreciate it. We wouldn't have known had you not told us.
No.
And it's interesting because most of the time, because we are such an isolated community, you generally know if people are getting things commissioned. But we didn't know. He came and told us, and it actually ruled him out of a third place.
He would have got third, that's right.
For that particular event.
Luckily, because it was actually a joint third, so we didn't have to then go and try and make a decision over who would get third and who wouldn't, because he was no longer eligible.
Yeah.
So that was awesome.
But it did mean that it essentially ruled him out of that podium finish. He'd still got a recognition for that.
Yeah, because the parts that he painted were actually great.
And the whether he painted it to match the commission or the commission painted it to match him, someone did a good job.
Yeah.
But it meant that he was essentially disqualifying himself by being honest.
Yep.
But I think it came at the betterment of the rest of the event because everyone not only recognised the fact that, hey, wow, there were some really awesome painted armies in the room, but he was honest.
Yeah.
And I think everyone appreciated his honesty by saying, yeah, look, guys, you know what? I can't claim a painting award for something I only painted part of,
yeah.
And, you know, there's plenty of people around the world. I'd be really keen to understand how other people deal with that particular issue in other parts of the world. But for me, personally, I think I have a far greater appreciation for an army that someone has spent the time and effort to paint themselves, regardless of the standard.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, though, because I guess it's something
that... ironic, since I do commission painting.
Yeah, well, that's true. But it's something that I'm, I guess, still trying to get my head around, because I think, okay, you're doing a commission job at the moment. The person that you're doing that for, if he's painted the rest of his army, should his whole army be disqualified because you're painting one model? Or should he be able to just take that one model off the table and have the rest of it judged based on that? And I know that at the moment that we've decided that no, we're going with if you've had any of it painted by somebody else, then the whole thing isn't eligible.
Just to clarify why that is, at least in my headspace at the moment, and please feel free to elaborate your own version of why this is or isn't right. If I have three players who are vying for third place, one of them did not paint a single piece of it, and it's all commissioned. One of them painted 1,500 points of a 1,750 point army, and he's taken those models off, and the last one's painted it all.
The whole thing.
Who's put the most effort in?
Yeah.
And in my mind, by allowing people to remove commission painted models from the table is actually a detriment, because then they've only had to paint 500 points or 600 points and they can spend more time on those models when someone else has painted their entire army to that standard.
And I hear what you're saying, I really do. And we could debate this for absolutely hours and we don't have time. I guess what I think is, does it come down to who's put the most effort in, or does it come down, you know, at times there's, is it who's got the most skill? And
the problem with commissions is it can also be who's got the most money to employ the best artists.
Yes, but if you have to take that off the table, then that comes out of it. It's not around who's got the most money, because it's around what's left. And do you go, okay, well, we're prepared to say X percentage, and that just gets a bit tricky. So as
you can see, we're kind of still working through that one.
And this is, I guess, so that you understand, these are the kinds of processes that we do tend to go through for making the decisions. We don't just make snap decisions. It generally tends to be Michael putting his perspective forward and me going, yeah, look, I get that, but, and him going, yep, okay, but, and then that can go on for days.
Well, yeah, weeks even.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, this document isn't something we've snapped out.
No.
It's something that's been sort of brewing in the background for a number of months and probably
we've been debating stuff around sports scores for
day one till now.
Yeah, I was going to say probably about 12 months.
Longer than that.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with soft scores.
It is.
But that's not what this is about.
I've digressed.
Setting a standard that as long as everyone's made the appropriate sort of aims to meet the standards. If you can't meet the standards and you're up front, come and tell us. We'll have a quiet chat to you. We'll say thank you for being honest.
Yeah.
And we'll ask.
And then we'll ban you from every event that we've run. No, not really. I'm joking.
We'll ask that next time, like this, it will be a first and final warning.
Yeah.
And we will stick to our guns the second time around. And we don't want to be the bad guys, and we don't want to be the hobby police.
He does, really.
If I'm going to be police, I wouldn't be playing pointy, corsair pirates. Arr. Yeah, welcome to my world.
But yeah, I'm new to it.
For me, on a personal note, it's about that show of respect. I put a lot of effort into painting my armies, and I spend a lot of time on them. I don't expect people to meet my standards, and I certainly can't meet some of the standards that other people can. But I hope that they can appreciate that I have gone to the effort to put an army down that's reflective of my commitment to giving both players an enjoyable experience.
Hmm.
And I don't know whether that's the same for everyone, but that's how I feel about it. So until I teach you how to play, or until you take the rule book and go and read it, because I don't think we'd survive in a marriage if I tried to teach you 40K.
We really wouldn't.
Until we can have that conversation, maybe we can get her into 8th ed, guys. I think we can wrap this topic up here.
Okay, I just need to put out, Bostik is the brand and Blu-Tack is the product.
Okay, did you Google that one?
I did Google it.
On that note, we'll take a quick break and we'll wrap up the episode. Wrap the episode up now. We've kind of covered the Bill of Rights in a very broad and brief way at the same time.
Roundabout way.
Yeah.
Lots of tangents.
I suppose I just want to reiterate, it's not about excluding people. It's just about us trying to level the playing field, set the standards, and give everyone that understanding and information up front.
And I think it's about just trying to clarify the expectations.
Yeah. We want to provide the best possible experience, and I suppose integral to that experience is players' behaviour, players' language, and their armies, and it's a really complex place to be to try and deliver that experience. And we hope that this Bill of Rights isn't a negative thing. We hope that it helps enhance events by giving players the understanding that we are trying to achieve a premium event. We are trying to give the best possible tables of terrain that we can.
Yeah.
We bashed out. We now have 25 tables worth of terrain. I've got two more pieces to do to finish box 25.
But you've been here for 2 weeks now.
We just keep
looking at it going, not tonight.
So it really is about us trying to provide a premium experience, and we really hope that you can get on board and try and be part of that, because I really do think we've had some fantastic looking armies and some fantastic looking events, and
I absolutely love the events that we run. You know, I really do. I really think the whole, the atmosphere and the environment, it is just, if you haven't been to one, please come down and check it out.
Yeah, just as a visitor.
Just as a visitor, because I can't describe the atmosphere in the room.
It's not like anything you're familiar with outside of gaming, though, is
it? No, but it's also nothing like I've experienced for however many of the other events that I've been to. I think maybe that's to do with the volume of players we have and the volume of the players that we have. You know, it really, yeah, the atmosphere is just amazing.
Yeah, and we want to make sure that every part of the event is amazing.
Yeah, you know, and our players are they're inclusive and they're...
Yeah, look, you can't take anything away from the guys, even the ones who...
Or the ladies.
Even the ones who've come and asked and sought clarification on these things, everyone's been really cool. They've listened to very lengthy emails. But, you know, everyone's been really adult about it and have been willing to have those open conversations. And I'm really proud that we have been able to engage players in an adult way and that everyone's been really understanding and been willing to talk about it and understand where we're coming from and what we're trying to achieve. And I hope that they continue to support us in those endeavours, because we really do want to bring the best we possibly can and we want to continue to improve.
Yeah.
And part of that improvement process sees the players grow as much as we do.
Yeah.
And whether that's learning new hobby tips or just getting more stuff painted and on the table, I think all of those things are worthy goals for us to aim for, both as players, myself included, and as event organisers ourselves.
Yeah, definitely.
So on that note, we're going to wrap up the episode. Emma will be back again for a future episode. You heard her on Drunkhammer. I think it was a great way for you to have your first podcast.
I'm still slightly scarred from that, I'll admit.
If you haven't listened to episode 7, go and check
it out.
Oh, yeah,
maybe don't.
We do try and keep our episodes PG. That one definitely is not PG.
Oh, no.
And it does ramble. Unusually.
A little bit, yeah.
But until next time, guys, we hope you enjoyed the episode. Feel free to send us feedback, social media, the website, email, however you want to do it. Thank you very much, Emma.
Ah, it's lovely to be here.
Until next time, guys, play more tabletop games. You've been listening to the Objective Secured podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website, objectivesecured.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/objectivesecured, or you can email us, obsec@optusnet.com.au. Thanks for listening.